This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Box office top 10 this week at 10. The knowing people say AVPR. Everyone else says Aliens vs. Predator Requiem.
Everyone else says go watch those Miyazaki films at home on video because they're so much more intelligent and you don't have to waste your money on this tripe.
Underdog at number 9.
Sorry, again, because I took a child to see it and I laughed the first time round. Not muchly, but it's okay, but I really like it because of Peter Dinklage. I mean, it's rubbish, but it's a flying dog movie with Peter Dinklage in it. Second time round, big thumbs up from the kids.
Now, at number 8, it's St Trinians. Steve from Angmering says, Simon and the Good Doctor, my wife had an evening out with some girly friends last week and chose the local provincial cinema to provide their entertainment. Imagine my shame when, on her return, I learned that they had just spent 2 hours of their lives watching the latest St Trinian movie, a film so bad in your eyes you have not even deemed fit to touch it with a barge pole of pithy comment during the top 10. So is he putting that right? My wife and her friends, all educated, professional people, clearly had a good time, and I thought that the Good Doctor might want to reevaluate his stance on this work. I wondered if he was taking a feminist as opposed to a more liberal post-feminist viewpoint, or if he was underestimating any postmodern irony intended by the producers, or should my wife and her friends be thoroughly ashamed of themselves?
Yeah, to answer that in reverse order, yes, they should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves. Postmodernism and irony is just another way of never having to say you're sorry, and I don't want to go and see it again because the first time round it was one of those, is it arch, is it knowing, is it no, it is none of the above. It is just a piece of rubbish British corpse digging. Let's drag out the old corpse and stick some, you know, somebody like Russell Brand into it and assume that somehow it will be saleable. It is a very badly made film. And on the post-feminist issue, if you manage to get past everything else that's wrong with it, yes, I do think there's something slightly suspect about its sexualization. But I think that's the least of its problems.
Alvin and the Chipmunks at 7. Problem with the sexualization there, I think, in that film.
It is, yes. I mean, I really think that the time has come that Chipmunks should be able to come out of the closet and
just
say,
be proud.
Look, this is how we sing. Stop laughing at it. It's not big and it's not clever.
P.S. I love you. At number 6.
P.S. That's good because nobody else does. I once saw somebody had a T-shirt, somebody who's religious, incidentally, which said, Jesus loves you, everyone else thinks you're an idiot.
And the point being?
P.S. I love you, but everyone else thinks you're an idiot.
Right. I saw the trailer.
Yeah, well.
In fact, the trailer is just before, it was on my copy of Control, the DVD, has got a PSI. It was kind of not really well placed, really.
Yeah.
But on the basis of the trailer, I thought, no, you're absolutely right. I just don't want to see it. My daughter would disagree, of course. No Country for Old Men's at number 5.
I think before
you proceed. Mm-hmm. Jenny in Camberwell, at the risk of upsetting the Venerable Doctor, I don't agree that No Country for Old Men is a great movie. Oh. It's a good movie with great moments, let down by a baffling ending. Tommy Lee Jones makes a speech that has to be up there with Sly Stallone's unintelligible diatribe at the end of First Blood. He didn't so much say the words as slide them out of his mouth like a bad ventriloquist. It's as if the Coen brothers got bored with the film and just finished it off quickly so that they could move on to another project. The Coens' strength as filmmakers, which is also their undoing in so many of their films, is that they're too clever by half when it comes to direction and script writing, don't focus enough attention on the emotional side of their characters. Up until the last 20 minutes, they'd made the perfect film. What a shame.
Well, I disagree wholeheartedly. Kenneth Branagh told me off for using the phrase too clever by half. He said that epitomises everything that gets my goat when people say too clever by half. And I said it to him, so I was guilty of it, and I will now use his riposte against it. They're not too clever by half. The Sly Stallone speech at the end of Rambo, I just want my country to love me as much as I love it, can in no way be compared to Tommy Lee Jones's heartfelt retelling of that dream sequence. And this doesn't necessarily make it right, but that's from the novel. I mean, that is the novel. And I think that what they've done is to boldly lift the novel up onto the screen. I think it ends perfectly. I think it's the perfect ending because you go, what?
Jenny continues or concludes on your theme of bad movies to take your parents to. No Country for Old Men is definitely not a date movie.
No.
It's not She's not really making the same point. I left the cinema disturbed. It took me 10 minutes before I worked up the courage to put my key in the front door.
But that, you see, I still think that is a date movie. Then again, when I was a teenager, I took somebody who I was going out with to go and see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And halfway
through, you know how to treat a woman.
Well, no, and here's what happened. Halfway through, she said, "This is horrible. I'm leaving." And I said, "Okay." And she said, "Well, aren't you coming with me?" And I said, "No, I want to see the film." And that was the end of that.
So many insights, so little time. I think we should continue that stuff you've taken your parents to, or they've taken you to.
And okay.
Because there was a whole batch of things where people went to see with their parents, then they didn't see anything again for 30 years.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yes, of course. Yeah.
No Country for Old Men is at number five. Penelope's at four.
I didn't like it at all, but I have to say the verdict from the 9-year-old girls in the stalls that it's funny. And again, Peter Dinklage is pretty much saving the day. What a terrific actor Peter Dinklage is.
Over Her Dead Body at three.
No.
Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street, number two.
The shame of it is that it's not up for more BAFTAs. I think it's a better film than the BAFTA nomination suggests, and obviously it's done better at the Oscars because Johnny Depp is up for Best Performer there, but it still hasn't gone as many awards as I expected it would.
And on the subject of the UK's number one film, Ian in Cheltenham, I finally went to see the much-hyped Cloverfield on Monday. I was really looking forward to it after the most positive reviews, including Mark's, but when I got to the cinema, I was greeted by signs saying that the film might not be suitable for those with motion sickness.
Yeah,
how bad could it be, I wondered. Unfortunately, I ended up with such terrible motion sickness. By about 40 minutes in, I had to sit through most of the film with my eyes shut or my head between my legs. What I saw was good, but I can't really say I enjoyed it overall, partly because I didn't actually see half of it, and partly because I felt like I was going to be sick a lot of the time. I've seen Blair Witch, I've seen the Bourne movies, cope with both, but nothing prepared me for the constant hurl-inducing motion of this film. I did feel a bit unwell before going in, which might not have helped, but I think it was more the film than me. So my advice, if you have motion sickness, you really don't want to be going to see this. Can anyone tell me what I missed without spoiling it for others?
It's a big thingy going around New York, and it's a little bit like that thing out of The Host and a little bit like Gojira. And on the subject of movies that give you motion sickness, I tell you, that's wussiness speaking. If you want real motion sickness movie, go see Breaking the Waves, which is widescreen handheld wobbly. And not only is it a horrible film on every level and misogynist and evil and bad, that is the upchuck movie to end all upchuck movies.
It's clearly a bit like on the news when they say, you know, viewers might like to know this contains
strobe lighting
or strobe light, you know, flash photography and all that.
Yeah.
Clearly, there's somebody. If motion sickness is a problem for you, this is the kind of film that might be worth avoiding.
Well, apparently so. I mean, I don't get motion sickness, but in Breaking the Waves, even I came out with a raving headache.
And just one other thing on this, Simon. I went for dinner with my 13-year-old daughter Harriet after watching Cloverfield. We both gave it 7 out of 10. How nice to go for dinner with your 13-year-old. Yeah. Refreshing take on a monster movie, but basically, I think, a giant Lord of the Rings cave troll. Over our equally refreshing sorbet, she said out of the blue, "Name two films that include a turquoise sorbet." Which Simon says, "I challenge you." I carved a small Oscar statue out of my sorbet and presented it to her for most obscure movie trivia question. Unfortunately, there's no answer on this. So if there is a movie that, indeed two movies, that has a turquoise sorbet in it.
No, I'm sorry. I am officially stumped.
And do you know what? Doesn't matter, really, does it? On that?
I don't know. I mean, you mean in any way at all involves a turquoise sorbet? And why?
I don't know. The Juno review is coming up, one of the films that's been talked about an awful long time, as has this, There Will Be Blood, which finally gets to the odd cinema today.
So, new film by Paul Thomas Anderson. I mean, to say at the beginning, I love Paul Thomas Anderson. Remember when we were on Radio 1 and Boogie Nights came out, and I said, this, you know, it's up
How
there.
Long did you go on about that for?
I know, but I was proven right, because the fact is, he has had a fantastic career since then. Magnolia, which you really, really love, with the
film,
Plague of Frogs and everything. Punch Drunk Love, which is extraordinary, and the Adam Song, the movie that it's okay to like, and really sort of mad love story in which one of the most loving thing that anyone says to anyone is, "You're so beautiful, I want to smash your face with a hammer." I mean, it's just so strange and peculiar. Now along comes There Will Be Blood, based apparently on a novel written in 1927 by Upton Sinclair, which of course I haven't read. The novel is called Oil. The story is a turn of the century prospector. At the beginning, he seems to be looking for gold, digging around in a cave, and then he strikes oil. And having struck oil, there is then, and that appears to be accidental, his co-worker is then struck in an accident, leaving him as the only potential father for an orphan child who is literally left sitting in a suitcase. And the rest of the film is then about this character, Daniel Day-Lewis, Daniel Plainview, and his expanding oil business. It's about the way he becomes an oil contractor, the way in which his relationship with his son, who is his adopted son, does and doesn't play out. And it is essentially about the discovery of oil and the loss of innocence and a whole bunch else. Right in the middle of it is the person I think everybody thinks is going to walk off with the Best Actor Award at the BAFTAs and also the Best Actor Award at the Oscars, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've traveled over half our state to be here tonight. I couldn't get away sooner because my new well was coming in at Coyote Hills and I had to see about it. That well is now flowing at 2,000 barrels and it's paying me an income of $5,000 a week. I have two others drilling and I have 16 producing at Antelope, so... Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree.
That voice is the thing that you come out of the movie ringing in your head. I mean, it is strangely hypnotic.
I'm trying to think who it reminds me of.
Does it remind you of somebody?
Yes. Some Canadian premier.
Okay.
Anyway,
I have to say it didn't remind me of anybody. It's one of those things in which it is the voice. People will end up imitating that voice. People will be doing parodies of that voice, and that's going to go down in history as the voice of the movie. Now, let's say a couple of things about the film. The first time I saw it, I was so thrown by it that I said I admired it, but I wasn't sure that I loved it. I really, really liked it. I knew it was, as I've said several times, it was like watching somebody reinvent the grammar of cinema before you, and it was so disorientating. I can't remember the last time I was in a movie when an hour in, I had no idea where it was going. I mean, you know, you literally didn't even know which genre.
People will hatch onto that and thinking, that's great, because they might think, great, because if Mark says that, then I'm happy to be lost at this point.
Exactly. It took me two runs at the film to really embrace it, and by the third time, I was just banging my head going, how could that, you know, why aren't I smart enough to just see this the first time and go, hallelujah, it's the second coming? But you know, that is there, it's the thing with there's some films that they are difficult and they require work, and they just require, you know, some kind of open-mindedness which you may not always have with. So the first time I saw it, I was really impressed, but I wasn't sure. Second time, I thought, no, this is really something. Third time, I was breathless with it. The first 20 minutes is just extraordinary, because as we heard before, there's no dialogue, but there's this noise, there's this sound. You remember in Punch Drunk Love, and it's the same in Magnolia, there's so much going on in the soundtrack that does the storytelling. The opening 20 minutes is literally Daniel Day-Lewis scrabbling around in a cave. You have this incredible sense of doom and impending catastrophe and stuff happening. And why is it the performance? It's coming from the score by Johnny Greenwood, who is in Radiohead,
yes,
and who, as I said, has, you know, wrongly not been nominated for an Oscar. It's complete. I mean, it's just foolhardiness. I don't understand this technicality thing, but it's an extraordinary score. The whole film is beautifully shot by Robert Elswit, who gives it this kind of end of the world look. These kind of great big expanses of open desert with these big rigs that variously, you know, groan like monsters. I mean, you think Cloverfield is a monster movie. There Will Be Blood is a monster movie, and occasionally they burst into flames. The story is about, you know, fatherhood and the sins of the fathers. I think, as the title suggests, it's biblical. And a key element in it is a kind of battle of wills between Daniel Day-Lewis, who, his character says, I basically hate everyone. And this other character played by Paul Dano, who is a sort of an evangelical preacher who wants the oil to fund his church. But so there's a religion and oil thing going on. And of course, the first time I saw it, the politics of it didn't really strike me at all. But the second time you start thinking, hang on, I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff here which is to do with war and to do with Iraq. But what's really clever about the film is that at no point does it flag any of that stuff up. It's there if you want to find it. If you want to see oil and politics, and I mean, the religion is clearly there. If you want to see those things in it, there they are for you. But at no point is Paul Thomas Anderson going to shovel them to you. As I said, the wonderful thing about it, it's like being on a ship when you've got no idea where this ship is going.
Okay, so here's the thing.
Yeah.
Given that most people listening to this have absolutely no intention of seeing it more than once.
Yes.
But there'll be something. But in general, people see a film once, and then they maybe see it a couple of years later.
Yes.
On a DVD.
Yeah.
Prime us, okay? What do we need to know? What do we need to read? Maybe it's worth looking up something. Maybe I don't know. What do we need? I only want to see it once.
Here's what I would say. You can prepare yourself for it by watching Punch Drunk Love, because
I don't want to.
No. Well, Punchdrunk Love is 84 minutes long.
I haven't got it.
Well, you just told me to give you a book to read. That's
okay, I just want to look something up and read it in a minute or two.
You're the Wikipedia generation. If it's not on the internet, I'm not bothered.
So watch Punchdrunk Love.
No, or don't. I didn't bring this up. I didn't suggest it. All I would say is this. Firstly, go in sober. Right? You need your wits about you. Go in sober. Clean your ears out. You know, do the thing. Make sure you sit yourself in the cinema, if this is at all possible, away from other human beings.
Oh, now that's...
It's not a film in which you want to be annoyed by the guy behind you kicking or somebody else, you know, doing a deal on the telephone or something. You know, you want to be... Go and see it in an afternoon performance in a weekday when, you know, there's unlikely to be anybody else around. Because it is an overwhelming experience, and you have to be, have you ever seen Altered States? The Ken Russell film, yeah.
But it's about
sensory deprivation, you know. You need to be like William Hurt in the sensory deprivation tank. You know, you're lying in fluid that is completely body temperature and nothing is bothering you, so that the wave of experience...
Okay, so I've got another thing. So either read the book, watch Punch Drunk Love, or... What you're saying is go in and buy three seats. If you've got a cinema with numbered seats, say, I want three, and I want to sit in the middle so that I
haven't
had a drink.
And buy the one in front and the one behind.
All right, so I've got to buy five seats, including the one I'm going to sit in.
Yeah.
This is making it a very expensive
evening.
Buy five seats. This is great.
And make sure you sit in the middle so you get the full doubly stereo sound.
Okay, so you've got to sit in the middle, no one in front, no one to the side, no one behind you, be sober.
That's it.
Watch Punch. It must be 100 quid and counting now.
Yeah, it is. But believe me, you're not going to regret spending the money.
On the subject of the Daniel Day-Lewis voice.
Yes.
Which reminded me of somebody. Whole number of people joining in this because it reminded them of someone too, including Sean Connery, John Huston, Richard Nixon.
No, really?
Baz Luhrmann in Wear Sunscreen, Matt in Cardiff. Kathleen. Actually, well, let's play it again and see where we go. So here's this voice which people are trying to place. Here's Daniel Day-Lewis again.
There was no one aspect as opposed to any other. It was just that.
No, not that one. That's him being talking. Although his normal talking voice always slightly troubles me as well because I can't ever quite place that. No, we mean the clip when he does the talking.
Not the movie. Here's a couple of other suggestions. Kathleen in New Albany, Indiana. Before you even began asking, who is that voice reminiscent of? I was thinking to myself, he sounded remarkably like John Huston in Chinatown, an ominous undertone.
Oh, you know what? And that's a fascinating as well, because of course there is clearly a thematic connection between There Will Be Blood and Chinatown. The oil in There Will Be Blood and the water in Chinatown, I mean, they are very similar stories. I'm sorry, slapping my head again, though I didn't say that earlier, and thank you very, very much for bringing that up. That's a very interesting connection, and you're right, the voice is similar, but actually thematically that's a very smart link.
This is the voice we're talking about.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've travelled over half our state to be here tonight. I couldn't get away sooner because my new well was coming in at Coyote Hills and I had to see it wasn't.
With an element of Mr.
That
Anderson.
Well is now flowing at
2,000.
There's a little bit of the Matrix.
There's a little bit of that guy who's actually Australian.
Yes.
What's his name?
The guy
from
the Matrix.
Yes,
him.
Is actually Australian, whose name I can't remember. Oh!
FIFA Vendetta.
Yeah. No, it'll come. It won't come now.
We're just going to sit in silence now until it does
come. No, don't, because I can't.
I think we should.
No.
Until we're told who that is, because it's such a bad thing.
Mr. Anderson. That's right. It is. It's the guy from The Matrix who's actually Australian doing an impression of John Huston in Chinatown. I'm so glad we got there.
We can't go on now until we're... It's Hugh...
Hugo Weaving.
We got there eventually. Matthew in Exeter... absolutely right, Simon. It is the... I said it sounded like a Canadian ladies. Brian Mulroney, says Matthew, our Prime Minister during the 80s and 90s, and it was driving me nuts.
Oh, really?
Sam in Bournemouth, Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood, strangely similar to Larry David in Curb Your Enthusiasm. And just one other, Burt Lancaster in Local Hero has been suggested.
No.
I think it's Hugo Weaving meets Brian Mulroney.
Oh, no, although actually there is a touch of Burt Lancaster in Local Hero.
McIntyre,
yes.
Anyway, we should move on. But before we do, final thing here, Alan, the beleaguered cinema manager, says about the guy who took his 13-year-old to see Cloverfield, does that man realise it's a 15,
oh, therefore was it? Not a 12?
Or never mind your turquoise sorbet. Did he lie to get his child into the cinema? Did the cinema staff not care? Despite being a cinema manager for more than 8 years, it still depresses me that adults think they don't have to abide by the BBFC's ratings. Would it be possible for you or Mark to explain the meaning of the ratings, especially 12A, 15 and 18, in 30 seconds?
I'm sorry, I did think that because it was a 50, it was a 12A, yeah. I beg your pardon. Right. I thought it was 12A. Okay, here's the way, you know how it works. PG parental, you suitable for anybody except for under fours. PG parental guidance, 12A, anybody under 12 has to be accompanied by an adult, and the lower age limit is generally thought to be 8, which was almost considered to be mandatory. 15 means nobody under the age of 15. You're quite right, if Cloverfield is a 15. And 18, what used to be the old X certificate, no one under the age of 18 admitted.
So never mind your turquoise sorbet and all that nonsense.
The police will be round. We're passing your details on to them even as we speak.
Okay, so Juno has been talked about a lot. Yeah. It's Oscar nominated. We have some correspondence on it already, but you go first as you're the good dog.
Well, you know, Ellen Page up for a number of awards, best actress at the Oscars. She's going head to head with Sam Riley in that Rising Star Award at the BAFTAs.
Well, no, that's Elaine Page. Sam
Ellen
said
Page,
it was
yes,
Elaine Page.
Elaine Page, yes.
Be a
which
big
is,
surprise.
But it's a public vote. So, I mean, that's not a committee or anything. That's a public vote. So who knows which way that's going to go. Basically, Juno has been seen as this year's Little Miss Sunshine in that it's a contestant at the Oscars in the best film category. Indie spirited little movie, although, you know, obviously studio background, which has made a huge amount of money in America, has gone past the $100 million mark, despite the fact that it looks for all the world like this, you know, edgy little indie, oddball, offbeat, strange story, starring Ellen Page, who I think is terrific. If you remember when Hard Candy came out a couple of years ago, and I just said this kid is fantastic. Hard Candy is an extraordinarily edgy horror movie come, you know, slasher thriller about a young girl who turns the table on some sleazy internet creep, and it's brilliantly done. Anyway, so here she is in Juno. Story is, she's a 16-year-old, smart-mouthed 16-year-old girl who discovers that she's pregnant.
No, it's Morgan Freeman. Do you have any bones that need collecting? I'm pregnant.
What? Honest blog?
Yeah. Yeah, it's Bleakers.
It's probably just a food baby. Did you have a big lunch?
No, this is not a food baby, all right? I've taken like 3 pregnancy tests and I am for shiz up the spout. I'm telling you I'm pregnant and you're acting shockingly cavalier.
Is this for real? Like for real, for real?
Motion that I was searching for on the first take.
So, are you gonna go to Havenbrook or Women Now? Because you know you need a note from your parents for Havenbrook.
Yeah, I know. No, I'm gonna go to Women Now, just because they help out women now.
Now, one of the criticisms that's been lodged against the movie is that, well, you know, well, hey, teenagers don't talk that smart. The film is written by a woman called Diablo Cody, who, this is all the tabloids picked up on this, used to be a stripper, or she at some point in her life was a stripper. And she was rated by one of the American magazines the 38th smartest person in Hollywood. And so consequently, this is a tabloid story waiting to happen.
Is
you
that
know.
Almost an insult, isn't it?
The 38th smartest, lying. Yes, exactly. What number was Tom Cruise? And some people have said, look, it's far too clever for its own good. Kids don't talk in this smart way. You know, that's rather like saying those Marx Brothers movies are rubbish. Nobody talks like Groucho Marx, or, you know, all that Shakespeare is rubbish. Nobody actually talks like that. I can't stand it when people say that in itself is a criticism. It's like the Quentin Tarantino thing. There's nothing wrong with Quentin Tarantino making people talk in a way that people don't talk like that. The problem is that he can't do anything else. And in movies in which he wants to do something else, he fails. In this case, the key voice in this is the voice of Diablo Cody, but I don't see any problem with Ellen Page talking in the way that she does, or her friends talking in the way she does. It's a smart, funny, inventive, laugh-out-loud script. Boom. Point one. Point number two, what then happens is that Juno decides to keep the baby and have the baby adopted, and she then looks around for a couple to adopt the unborn child, and she then finds this very, very middle class couple who are desperate to adopt her unborn child. And it's a comedy about the way in which their relationship sort of works out. And some other people have said, oh well, therefore it is a political movie about the pro-life movement. It's not. I mean, it's just because she decides to have the baby doesn't make the film a political statement. If there is a statement to be made, it is about the fact that that the young protagonist actually has ideas and thinks for herself and isn't completely all at sea. And also, it is much more radical in its attitude towards its characters than, for example, a comedy like Knocked Up, which again, it's the, you know, somebody gets pregnant, decides to have the baby, and the sexual politics of Knocked Up seems to me to be far more suspect, which is that in the end, the dorky fat guy is going to end up with a glamorous hot TV presenter because of this pregnancy, which is just like, what world is this happening in? This is just kind of like Revenge of the Nerds made into some, it's pseudo-realistic fantasy. So what you have with Juno, you have a story, young, smart heroine who is kind of in control of her own destiny, even when she's kind of out of control of it. She makes a decision that appears to be her own decision. It's made for reasons which are very personal. When she goes to the Help Women Now clinic, she doesn't like the smell of it, and it's a bit difficult. So she says, "Oh well, you know, I'm gonna have the baby and have the baby adopted." And on all those things, it's not a polemical movie. It's not meant to be a polemical movie. What it's meant to be is an entertaining comedy with people that you could like, people that you actually think, "I want to spend some time with these people. They're fun. They're entertaining." It's directed by Jason Reitman, who is Ivan Reitman's son, and he does a much better job here than he does in things like, for example, Thank You for Smoking. Good supporting performances from the rest of the cast. Now, again, I've seen this a couple of times. First time I saw it, I really liked it in a way that I never really liked Little Miss Sunshine. I always thought Little Miss Sunshine kind of copped out and, you know, it ended up wanting us all to love the things that actually I think it should have had us hating, you know, the young underage beauty pageants, which I just think that stuff is creepy, creepy, creepy. And yet the film, and of course when you listen to the director commentary on Little Miss Sunshine, it's all there. That's exactly what they wanted. In the case of Juno, it is that most lovely of things, genuinely offbeat and charming, and dealing with a subject that could be a total minefield, particularly in America. You can't make a populist movie in America about a 16-year-old pregnant girl, but you know what? They just did.
And this from Pierce in Dublin. Saw Juno last weekend with a script that is possibly too smart for its own good at times. The film is completely redeemed by an outstanding cast and clever, understated direction. While many of the plaudits may go to Ellen Page's performance, I thought Jennifer Garner was simply outstanding.
Many critics agree. Jennifer Garner playing the adoptee mum. Many critics do agree with that.
So much so that after the film, I went and rented out Elektra again, just to make sure it is still absolute rubbish.
It is. It's
which,
bizarre.
Of course, it still is. Has the good doctor ever had an experience where his perception of a particular actor has been changed by one performance? Is Julian Sands due a reprisal, perhaps?
No, a very good point, and it's Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love. I mean, I've just, every time I gear up to do the Adam Sandler, I just want to smack his face. I think of Punch Drunk Love, and I crawl into a hole and realise that it doesn't matter what he does, because he did Punch Drunk Love, and he was brilliant in it.
Stuart says, "Dear Simon and Dr. K, I saw Juno a couple of weeks ago, and I really can't see what all the fuss is about. It is an average US teen flick trying way too hard to be cool. I liked Ellen Page in Hard Candy, but in this film she is just plain annoying. I found her relentless delivery of lame comic one-liners in every scene really irritating. Frankly, it's pretty rubbish, and I know I'm right because, one, you see how you're affecting people's criticism.
I know. You said a whole bunch of earlier on
because
today.
One, I've seen the film advertised on the side of more than a few buses.
That doesn't, the rule doesn't work.
To your previously discussed topic about this rule, bus poster equals bad film, which in general is true, but not always. Mm-hmm. And two, my wife thought it was rubbish too, and she is never wrong. So there you go.
Well, can
no
I just say
that's it? No one's
I disagree with the whole letter, except for I applaud the final sentiment.
What? Because your wife says
your wife's
wrong.
Never wrong.
Exactly. Irresponsible Simon with his 13-year-old daughter Harriet, who went to see Cloverfield and sent some people off trying to discover turquoise sorbets in movies. Stephen in Bedford, just to finish, I think this is going to go on for much longer. Pretty Woman has what looks like a turquoise sorbet at a posh meal with clients. Kevin in Windsor, Babette's Feast and Big Night both have blue ice type desserts in.
Okay.
And the Koreans in What's Cooking serve a blue though not turquoise sorbet.
There must be something in La Grande Bouffe. I thought you were going to make a joke about there's a turquoise sorbet and Julia Roberts is wearing it.
Lots more correspondence. We'll try and get through as much of it as possible before 4 o'clock. However, there are some interesting movies.
There are
still
third great big, you know, humdinger of the week, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, a new film by Julian Schnabel based on the memoir or autobiography of Jean-Dominique Bauby, who was a fashion editor who was struck down by a hideous stroke which left him with locked-in syndrome, meaning he could not move anything other than one eyelid. And at the beginning of the film, we see from Jean-Dominique's point of view, him looking out at the world, unable to move, and the doctor's looking at him and looking at his eye and not knowing whether his eye is working and deciding that actually, since it isn't working and it's drying up, they're going to have to sew it closed. And I was sitting there in Cannes when the movie started, and I started to have something approaching a panic attack, because I thought, I can't, you know, it's like that really claustrophobic thing that you get, for example, at the end of the Corman Edgar Allan Poe's. I mean, it's really terrifying. And whether are you claustrophobic? You ever think
about being
buried alive, or follow the House of Usher and, you know, we have put her in her tomb alive? No.
No.
Nothing that bothers you?
Not really. I did dream the other day I put on a Neil Diamond record by mistake. Does that count?
Not really.
Okay.
Not the same level of terror. Anyway.
Well, I don't know.
What's wonderful about the film
is... It was Song Sung Blue.
I like that. I like that, and I like Sweet Caroline.
Okay.
But
where do you stand on Brother Love's Travelling Salvation Show?
Don't know, but I didn't like the remake of The Jazz Singer.
Keep going.
Okay, so with such bleak subject matter, what's extraordinary about Diving Beyond the Butterfly is that it's such a wonderfully sensuous experience as a movie. Now, this is important to say. Julian Schnabel is an artist, and often artists, you know, going into cinema don't make the best films. They make kind of art installations. And his two previous films, Basquiat and Before Night Falls, I didn't like, and I didn't see in them any evidence that he was a great filmmaker. What I saw was evidence of, you know, an artist dabbling in the medium of film. So when I saw Diving Beyond the Butterfly, I didn't go in thinking this is a great filmmaker. I went in wondering how this was going to work out, and I was really taken aback by just how wonderful a piece of filmmaking it is. I mean, it's, when I say sensuous, it's a kind of film that you can touch and smell, and you can feel it in your fingers, and it's, and feel it in my toes, and I'm going to sing Love Is All Around.
No, please.
And that's the way it goes. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that, that's really awful. But it is, it's, and for a film about a man whose body is paralyzed, because what he did was he narrated his memoirs by blinking, and as he blinked, there's somebody, they figured out how to recite the alphabet to him in a certain conjunction of what are the most common letters, and he would blink when they got to the right letter, and they did word by word by word, and this extraordinary memoir, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, came out, in which he described in unbelievably poetic terms his life then and now. And he said very clearly in this that he really didn't know he was alive before, and now through this extraordinary life-changing experience he had become alive. And I then interviewed Julian Schnabel for the Culture Show, and one of the message boards on, I think it's The Guardian or whatever, somebody said, oh, did you see Mark Kermode's interview with him? He was fawning all over this director. He was, you know, the reason I was fawning all over him was, I love that film, and I was astonished at how good it was, because I never thought Julian Schnabel was a great filmmaker.
Can I just say,
yeah,
shame on you for actually reading the message boards.
Oh, no, I was directed to it by somebody who said, you know, but, you know, I mean, I'm not even a broadband boy.
You have
a total non-reading policy, don't you?
I don't read message boards in general, no.
No, but if anybody says to me, "Have you seen?" Anyway, so you know, yeah, you're right, shameful. But it was. But what I'm saying is, when I met him, this kind of enthusiasm for the movie. I mean, it's real. I'm feeling it again now. I really love the film. I think it's a fabulous piece of filmmaking. I think, you know, again, the Oscars, it's not nominated for Best Foreign Language Film, because the way that the Oscars do it is that the country has to nominate their own film. So France have nominated La Vie en Rose, which is a far inferior film, although of course it is a French production, although it is actually a French-US co-production, so there's an argument for Diving Beyond the Butterfly. It makes no odds. It's a wonderful piece of work. You know, we had Ronald Harwood, the screenwriter, on
a couple of times, yeah,
and he's done a brilliant job of adapting the book, and then of course it's been translated into French, but it's the visual language of it, and it is that thing about the visual language, the language of cinema, which transcends national boundaries. The soundtrack, the feeling, it's a film of such texture. And I don't care if I look like I was fawning over the guy. I think he made a great film. I think he's a true filmmaker. And I was wrong about him. I never had that man down as a good director.
Tom in Wandsworth. Simon and Mark, seen some great films recently, but Diving Bell and the Butterfly is absolutely mesmerising. Julian Schnabel has done an amazing job of transforming a seemingly unfilmable book into something that actually transcends Jean Doe's moving account.
Exactly.
If only he could put down the paintbrush and make more films, truly a formidable talent.
Yes, and I wouldn't have said that on the basis of his first two films, but his third film, it's like he was struck by lightning or something, or touched by the hand of God, and something happened, and suddenly he's become a filmmaker. You know, Ken Russell once said that the moment that he converted to Catholicism was the moment that the light went on and he became a filmmaker. And it's like that. There's something that happens in people, something goes bing, whatever it is, and suddenly they're a filmmaker. And that's how I feel about Schnabel. Suddenly, he's a filmmaker.
Brief bit of correspondence. Steve, this is on the subject of seeing film in inappropriate company, mm-hmm. usually parents. I watched, excruciatingly embarrassing evening 15 years ago. I watched I'd recently turned 18, and myself and my then girlfriend sat down to watch Basic Instinct on video with my parents.
Oh, looks almighty.
Three quarters of the way through, my dad actually apologised to my girlfriend for the content of the film. Joe on this, not quite parents, but in the 1970s, when my sister and I were children, my staunch Irish Catholic grandma volunteered to take us to the cinema. Not a massive movie buff, she chose Shout at the Devil. I still love Lee Marvin to this day. And Graham says, this is on the subject of Because 4, There Will Be Blood, you have to buy the seat in front, buy the seat to the left and right and behind you, just so that you have, and sit in the middle and not be drunk, so you have the full cinematic experience. Graham says, my local cinema offers seats for £3 on a Wednesday, so I can follow Mark's advice for £15. Sadly, I will have to sit with a pool of wee beneath my feet and constant chatter. I haven't finished yet. And constant chattering from the ladies trying to... because you just love it. So,
okay.
Just time for another movie before we finish.
Let's very quickly start.
Buying a Putinuk on Trent just for that full cinematic experience. £15, yes, but there are ladies behind you. Anyway, go on.
Pool of weed. Do this because we've got three. Definitely apartheid Manhattan comedy, which begins with somebody compared it to Annie Hall, and which it doesn't deserve comparison with at all. Story is, there's a husband and his wife, and he also says, oh, it's Abigail Breslin, incidentally, who is the little girl out of Miss Sunshine, and she says, tell me the story of how you and Mummy met. And he decides that actually, rather than doing that, he'll tell her a story. And the little girl has to decide which one is her mother. During, and every now and then we go back to the little girl saying, oh, so is it that girl? And then that girl, and it's, and you keep forgetting, and it enables them to have a punchline, which is that the story has a happy ending, and the happy ending was you.
Duh.
At which point it was like, pass me the bucket. It's not terrible. It's not much good. And it's, you know, it's very sort of Richard Curtis, although it doesn't end up with a rush to the airport or somebody making a huge public declaration of love over a loudspeaker system. But it's kind of in that area, and it's nothing to do with. So get fixable. Forgettable. Also at Water Horse Legend of the Deep. If you've seen the trailer for Water Horse Legend of the Deep, right, it's a kids' film, PG. Little boy finds an egg. Egg hatches. Needs water. Starts living in the loo. Gets two to live in the loo. They have to take it out into Loch Ness. Put it in Loch Ness.
Is this Dave Morrissey's film?
It is Dave Morrissey's film.
I saw
film.
Him this week.
Yeah, right. Fine. Well, those examples of films in this. Quite cute film. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, despite the fact, the young guy in it, the young lead, is the kid who was in Millions, and he does really well, particularly with a script that cuts him to say, and I'm not making this up, he has to say "jing" every other word, and he's surrounded by people who are called Jock and Jimmy, and then of course Dave Morrissey as the stiff face of British upper, you know, class, because it's in the middle of the war and the family have been billeted with the English army, the British army, and his mother is played by Bess McNeil from from Breaking the Waves, the movie that gives you motion sickness, and it's nice and charming and sweet and funny, but if you've seen the trailer, you've seen most of the film.
Weekly greetings to Jason Isaacs. We've
yes,
already
hello,
mentioned
Jason.
Dave, Sean Connery and Ken Branagh, but your movie of the week choice, it's a struggle.
Well, there will be. I know. There will be blood. But go and see Juno, and don't miss the diving bell and the butterfly. There will be the diving bell and Juno.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.